You're listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Those are the sounds of light winds on the planet Mars, as captured by LA scientists and engineers working at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in La Cañada, Flint Ridge, Pasadena. Up in their lab in the foothills of the Angeles National Forest, those scientists are leading the American effort to explore the red planet. The next step will come tomorrow when the Mars 2020 Perseverance rover is scheduled to blast off from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station in Florida. The mission? Gather a sample of the soil on Mars so scientists can begin to decipher whether that planet can sustain life, human or maybe something extraterrestrial.
I think with Perseverance, we have the opportunity to really make advances in our understanding of the potential for life elsewhere beyond Earth. But it's very likely that we won't be able to answer definitively whether there was life on Mars until we bring those samples back.
Katie Stack Morgan is the deputy project scientist for the Perseverance rover mission. Now, she says the rover ultimately will gather bits of information, so we might be able to answer an even bigger question. Are we alone in this universe? KCRW's Jerome Campbell talked to some of the folks who work on the Perseverance rover team and its mission and how the team is feeling ahead of tomorrow's launch, and he's here with us right now. Hey, Jerome.
Hey, Steve.
First of all, non-essential workers have spent a lot of time working from home during the pandemic. Did they build the rover from their living rooms? Is that what happened?
No. Well, the rover had already left JPL Laboratory for the Kennedy Space Center in Florida when the pandemic began. And this was good because it allowed the team to avoid delaying the launch by a couple of years. And in recent weeks, the team was also doing the bulk of their final testing from home remotely, which was not part of the plan. A couple of people on the team even say that they enjoyed doing their work from home so that they could be closer to their families, even if they didn't understand what was happening. Morgan, who we heard from earlier, told me that she's working on the interplanetary mission from a makeshift office in her laundry room, so her kids don't become too much of a distraction.
The Perseverance rover is set to gather evidence of life on Mars, digging into the soil, which other, by the way, other rovers have done as well. How is this one different? I mean, how are we characterizing this mission if we're just digging again?
Well, like you said, every rover has had something new to explore. The Mars rover Sojourner 97 gathered some just general information about Mars's atmosphere and geology, and has proved that humans could operate a rover on the next planet over. Then there was two other rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, that landed in 2004, and they found evidence that water existed on the planet at one time. Curiosity rover landed in 2012, and they were able to analyze soil samples to see if the planet could support life for small life organisms called microbes. And then the InSight lander, which landed in 2018, is examining the ground to determine how the planet formed. Now, all of that collection of data points towards the idea that Mars could possibly sustain life. Now, the Perseverance rover is looking even deeper for the evidence of life, and here's how Morgan put it.
Making advances in our ability to find potential biosignatures, which are textures, patterns, or substances that we think required life to form.
Now, don't hold your breath, though, because it's going to be about a decade before scientists even get a hold of those samples.
Jerome, we know that Mars is not a verdant place, although I guess in Hollywood you can grow potatoes on Mars, but it's not overflowing with life at the moment, water notwithstanding. Whether it used to be or not, we don't know. People are eager to know when humans will be able to go to Mars, might be able to venture to that planet. Is this mission going to make any headway on that goal?
Well, that's on the mind of a lot of people at JPL, like Elio Murillo. He calls himself a gremlin because his job is to stress test the operations of this rover and find out all the ways that something could go wrong and then find the solutions to them. And Murillo says this rover is also being outfitted with tools to help answer some of the more important questions about astronauts exploring Mars, like how will they breathe? How will they even get back? The atmosphere on Mars is mostly carbon dioxide, which obviously we can't breathe.
So what can we do with that carbon dioxide to convert it into usable oxygen so that then astronauts can use it to breathe and to survive on the surface, but also to use those products to create fuel for spacecraft they're going to need to return home.
There's also one project Mario is super excited about that's going up with the Perseverance rover. It's called the Ingenuity Mars Helicopter. It's about the size of a football and mostly will just be a proof of concept to see if they can fly something on Mars.
So the launch is planned for tomorrow morning. It always depends on the weather, obviously. It's summertime. We could have a pop-up thunderstorm. You just never know in Florida, right? This is Cape Canaveral on the East Coast, right?
Everyone's talking about the rover launching tomorrow, but it's really not guaranteed if it's going to happen. So when NASA was planning for the rover to launch, they set up a launch window that's going to be about 2 weeks from tomorrow all the way up to August 15th. And it just gives them time for just in case anything happens. If there's bad weather, if there's a last minute malfunction, they'll just be able to pivot that. And when I talked to Elio about how he's planning for the launch tomorrow, he right now he's in Florida and he's staying with his mom. Well, this is what he had to say.
I think I'm going to experience what parents go through when they see their kids go off to school and go off to college or whatever. My mom is making this cool cake that says Mars 2020 on it, and we're 3D printing a rocket to put on top of it. We're going to see this thing launch early in the morning, and honestly, we're probably going to party for the rest of the day and just celebrate that this thing is it's taken off. Cry a little. I have no doubts.
And if you want to watch the launch, you can see it on NASA's social media accounts, including YouTube and Facebook. But make sure you're up early because the first launch window is at 4:50 a.m. Pacific Coast Standard Time. Yeah, so set your alarm clocks.
Yeah, that's really early. I love that Elio is staying with his mom and mom is making a cake.
I know, so sweet.
Sort of puts everything into context, right? It's literally very sweet. KCRW's Jerome Campbell. Jerome, thanks for the story. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's KCRW's Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Well, back on Earth, and throughout the pandemic, coronavirus testing has been at the center of the fight against the virus. How many pictures have you seen of uncomfortable folks being poked in the nose with a long, invasive Q-tip? But as far as general testing up to now, there have been drive-through tests, drugstore tests, spit tests, serology tests, and rapid response tests. Some accurate, some not, some in supply, others not so much. Well, now a project at USC in conjunction with other schools is going to be doing a whole different type of testing. The project, funded by the National Science Foundation, is going to look at waste. Yeah, you heard that right, waste, to find out where the virus is most prevalent in LA County and other parts of the country. Adam Smith is an environmental engineering professor at USC's Viterbi School of Engineering, and he's heading up the project there. Adam, welcome.
Hey, Steve. Thanks so much for having me on.
Did I get that right, Professor? We're going to look at poop.
That's right. We're going to look at poop today.
Yeah. Tell us about the project. So what will that waste tell us?
Yeah. So although the virus that causes COVID-19 is a respiratory virus, it also infects many patients' gastrointestinal tracts as well. So then we subsequently shed it in our waste. So ultimately that goes through the sewer system and then ends up at a wastewater treatment plant. So what we're doing in Los Angeles and other parts of the country is we're collecting that wastewater that comes to the treatment plant, and then we're quantifying the genetic material from the virus to get sort of a community scale indicator of infection dynamics in Los Angeles.
So that's the goal. I wonder, so when I think about this and I think of you're trying to quantify how much waste has the virus in it, and then that will tell you how prevalent, how widespread the virus is in a certain place. How do you know how much waste one person has as opposed to another?
Yeah, so that's one of the issues that's still a little preliminary with our results and the research to date in terms of the number of viruses that someone might excrete in their waste and then that we can quantify back to the number of infections that are occurring. So right now, what we're using the data for is more to look at trends over time. So if we see an increase in the quantity of the virus in wastewater over time, we know that infections must also be increasing in that area.
LA County is sending its waste to these reclamation sites, so that data is not really going to help localize, as you mentioned. The other universities are doing the project too. Do they have the same sort of challenges? Are they able to localize the outbreaks in their places?
Yeah, so that is an issue in Los Angeles. We have a lot of very large treatment plants that serve multi-million people population. So our data, of course, is not very localized. But other municipalities, like, for example, Houston, who's on the project, they have 39 different treatment plants scattered throughout the city, many of which serve much smaller populations. So it helps you pinpoint where an outbreak could occur better. And I'll also point out we're doing this at a smaller scale at USC in the fall semester, where we're actually looking at wastewater from individual residence halls. So that gets at, better spatial resolution of an outbreak that could be occurring.
I mean, the one thing, Professor, that we've seen over and over again is there's this lag time, right? It takes a little while for things to show up. You know, we opened up, or things began to open up a little bit around Memorial Day. People started getting back out a little bit, and then we saw a few weeks later, things really get worse when it comes to the numbers of coronavirus. I mean, could this be an early indicator, if you do wastewater testing, of what's to come? And how long, by the way?
Yeah, I think wastewater testing could be a great early indicator. So obviously, it takes some time before symptoms develop in an individual, and then they go get tested. Then there's a lag between getting tested and the results, and then potentially hospitalizations. So wastewater, we're able to collect the samples and get to a result within about 48 hours. So it could be an early indicator of spikes that are yet to come in clinical diagnostic testing and even potentially hospitalization rates.
Spikes that are yet to come, but also in specific areas, right? You can, maybe not so much in LA because there are a few, there are what, six reclamation sites is what we said, but in other parts of the country where there are more, right?
Yeah. So if we have that spatial resolution, then it's all about diverting our healthcare resources effectively. And this is an extra data set and an extra tool that we can use to get there.
Are you working with any hospitals like to give them a heads up of, hey, look, you know, this is close to your area. Maybe you're going to see more people coming in.
Yeah, so we're working in Los Angeles at getting better spatial resolution with our sampling. And we're doing that actually in Santa Monica. So we're collecting wastewater from two different points in the sewer system there that serve a smaller population. And then we're also looking at wastewater downstream of St. John's and UCLA Hospital in Santa Monica. And we're using that really as a way to sort of calibrate the model that we're coming up with, since we know the number of COVID patients that they have at any given time. And then we can look at the data in the wastewater and correlate those two.
So you're trying, I see what you're doing here. You're trying to whittle it down to certain areas, localized areas. I get that.
Yeah.
And by doing that, then you can, focus more attention on a certain area, get more tests in that area, contact more people in that area to say, hey, look, you know, we've got pretty widespread COVID in that one place. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So these tests are very expensive. We already have very constrained testing resources. So all of those additional tests that are going to be occurring is problematic on the system. So by doing this, we have this community scale indicator, and then we can allocate those tests in a more informed way.
It's fascinating to me because, you know, in history, we've had pandemics before, most notably, of course, 100 years ago or more, the flu pandemic of 1918. Did we do the same types of things back then?
We didn't back then, but we have started to use wastewater-based surveillance in other applications for illicit drug use, antibiotic resistance, even like nicotine use in a community. But this is the first pandemic where we've really been using wastewater surveillance on a large scale.
How long is a project going to last? How long are you going to go with this?
Well, we have funding with NSF up until next May. So I think we'll be probably sampling for that whole duration. Or, of course, if the pandemic ends before then, which would be wonderful, we will stop sampling then.
I got to ask you before we let you go, how much ribbing are you taking about this? I mean, do you talk to your family and friends about, you know, hey, we're testing poop. I mean, what do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'm used to it. I've been doing this for a very long time. So I've been doing research on different technologies for water management for a long time. So I'm used to it.
I mean, we were having a conversation about, you know, I mean, just how kind of gross this is. But it's like everybody, you know, has waste. Everybody has a toilet, right? I mean, this is, yeah. It is kind of a no-brainer. And now perhaps it can be helpful in trying to isolate or at least tell us where there are pockets or intense pockets of coronavirus. Professor, I want to thank you. It's a fascinating study. I hope to find more information from you, too. Maybe we'll have you back on to talk about it. Adam Smith, an environmental engineering professor over at USC's Viterbi School of Engineering. Adam, thanks.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Well, moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW. And well, speaking of wastewater, here's a question for you. What do you think of when you think of the LA River? Maybe giant storm drain comes to mind, or maybe a scene that you saw in a movie. But what better place to soak in the sun and enjoy a relaxed outdoor adventure than a stroll down the LA River? One section called the Glendale Narrows off the 5 freeway between the 110 and the 2 looks a bit more like a real-life river and less like that giant storm drain. The bottom part of the river there is not covered over with cement. There are trees and shrubs and flowers that can grow, which means animals can come and hang out as well. Certainly with a pandemic, able to breed much easier within four walls, being outdoors is definitely in these days. Leela Higgins is Senior Manager for Community Science at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. She's a contributor, of course, here at Greater LA. Welcome back, Leela.
Thanks for having me again, Steve.
So when we say we're going on a nice stroll along the LA River, I mean, it's not like a scene from Greece or the Terminator.
If you went to downtown LA, like that is literally where Greece was filmed. And, you know, you could get an experience like that. Not sure if you're going to run into any car races today.
But there are more natural looking parts of the river, right?
Yes. So there's three areas that have what we call a soft bottom. So in the Sepulveda Basin, the Glendale Narrows, which we're going to talk about a lot today, and then down in the south, close to where it empties out in Long Beach, there's also a soft bottom.
All right. When you say soft bottom, there is concrete on the sides of the river, but the bottom of the river is sort of allowed to be al natural, right? You're able to grow trees and all kinds of brush and things like that in the middle of the river.
That's exactly what it's like in the Glendale Narrows. And yeah, there's the water table is so high there that you couldn't really put cement in the bottom. So when you go down in the Glendale Narrows, you can see that there's some cement going down into the edges, but then in the middle, there's all these rocks and kind of islands with vegetation growing on it and so many different animals.
What kind of animals are we talking about?
So I've seen giant fish. I've seen like giant carp. And you can see them kind of jumping out of the water sometimes. I've seen lots of birds. So many different species of birds. Great blue herons are like one of the really large, impressive species that you'll see. And black-necked stilts. They look like they're wearing a little tuxedo and they've got bright pink legs. yeah, they're really cute. Of course, lots of ducks, cormorants, which are a very black-looking bird, and they often spread out their wings and stand on rocks to soak in the sunshine, and they've got a long, kind of curved neck. So, just so many different species.
So, when you think about it, Leela, we spent many minutes talking about wastewater. I mean, it's not like a place that I would think of, you know, a natural habitat. Like you wouldn't jump in the river at that point, right? That's not is it a safe place to swim, I dare ask?
So right now we have a recreation zone, which is open. Usually you can do kayaking, but obviously that's closed down for the pandemic. But you can go down into the river in this area in the Glendale Narrows and bird watch. There are people down there who are fishing. You can walk along the edge of the river. I have seen people jump in the river. I've kayaked in the river many times. I haven't personally fallen in, but I've seen other people fall in. They've all lived to tell the story, so to speak. But yeah, the water is not 100% pristine and clear and pure because we humans have, you know, really messed up the river and the watershed.
You know, we're in the dry time of the year in LA. We've got months and months of no rain. Is there even water to go look at over there?
Yeah, there's a lot of water there right now. So historically, our river would be dry in the summer months and then, you know, sometimes just a trickle. And then in the winter months after rains, it would be like really full, and it's very dangerous during those storm times. So we have a higher flow of water coming out of the end of the LA River during a storm flow than the Hudson River has volume-wise, the Hudson River in New York.
But we're in late July right now. It hasn't rained since May. There's probably, you know, you're not worried about too much water in that part of the river.
Definitely not. We do have runoff from, like, you know, parks and things like that and from homes. So that water gets tertiary treated, which is like right below the level of treatment for drinking water. And then that gets added to the river. So the river level is higher than it would have been historically, but it's not, it's a slow flow. And it's kind of like that beautiful sound as it's going over the rocks. And so you can really sit down next to the river and get that sense of like, I am not necessarily in the city. I'm hearing all of these birds and insects buzzing around and that sound of water rushing over rocks.
The LA River, Lila, was a natural river, obviously. I mean, we look at it now and we see, you know, it was cemented over. And the reason it was cemented over is because as a natural river, it was just flooding. It was flooding many neighborhoods, made lives miserable. But I wonder, you know, since that cementing happened, what happened to the native, particularly the native fish species that were there? Are they still there, or are there new kinds of species?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So fish-wise, there really aren't any native species in the lower parts of the Los Angeles River. Like up in the mountains where the water ultimately comes from in the LA River watershed, there are going to be native species up there. Say like arroyo chub, which is a little tiny fish that we actually have in the pond at the museum. And we really wanted to showcase and highlight this native fish that most people don't know about. But down in the lower parts of the LA River in the Glendale Narrows, yeah, it's mostly non-native species. It's all non-native species, actually. So there's mosquito fish, which are the ones that Vector Control asks people to put into their ponds to deal with mosquitoes. Obviously, they eat them. There are Asian carp, which can get really giant and huge. But yeah, historically, there would have been steelhead trout and even like salmon would have been coming up into the river for spawning.
If you wanted to go there, Lila, you and I wanted to take a trip to the LA River and go for a walk, soak in the sun, as it were, where would we start?
So if you wanted to go explore the Glendale Narrows, also known as Frogtown, there are a number of places you could park. Unfortunately, MRCA has closed Marsh Park down, so you can't visit that, but the river pathway is open. You can go and explore and walk along the river pathway. Again, in certain sections, you can go down actually into the river channel. The recreation zone is open. And again, no kayaking, but you can get more up close and personal. If you bring your binoculars with you, you can go and check out birds. There's a bird called the osprey that is a fishing raptor. It's like a giant hawk-like bird, and they capture fish. And if you're really lucky, sometimes you can watch them catch a fish and then go and eat it on a light pole. That's wild.
Nothing like watching a bird eat a fish on a light pole.
Yes, it is absolutely nature in the city.
Nature in the city.
A native bird, a native raptor, eating a non-native fish.
Lila Higgins, Senior Manager for Community Science over at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County and co-author of Wild LA, Explore the Amazing Nature in and Around Los Angeles. Lila, always good to have you on.
Thanks, Steve.
That's our program for now. Tomorrow, meet a woman who survived coronavirus barely. How COVID-19 can take you from feeling like a 10 to 0 in a nanosecond. And yeah, art goes on, but has the relationship between human beings and art changed in a pandemic? We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Tell us what you think. What was your last trip to the LA River like? Any favorite places? Maybe you've never been. Subscribe to the podcast, too, while you're there. kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Kat Yore, Mario Saavedra, Jody Adler, Mike Newport, and Christian Bordahl all had hands and ears on this show today. Thanks for your ear and time this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Stay safe. Have a great night.